From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the hidden world of Islamic women. We talk with Geraldine Brooks, the author of a new book about women in Muslim countries. Brooks is a former Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. She says the more time she spent in Muslim countries, the more she was bewildered by the paradox between sexual license and repression. Also today, Libby Gelman-Waxner is proud to describe herself as America's most beloved and irresponsible film critic. Waxner writes a film column for Premiere Magazine, but she's really just a front for humorist, screenwriter, and playwright Paul Rudnick. Coming up, we talk with Rudnick about his alter ego. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two collections and a new release by country singer George Jones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House is working its way through a series of proposals for a balanced budget amendment. Lawmakers must choose among six versions. The one getting the most votes will receive a final vote in the House. Any amendment to the Constitution needs a two-thirds majority in both the House and Senate. So far, none of the House versions has gotten the 290 votes ultimately needed to pass. President Clinton has told the federal baseball mediator to try to resume stalled baseball talks. Mr. Clinton says if there's no settlement soon, the government may make its own proposal. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole has also delivered a veiled warning to both sides in the baseball strike.
We don't need legislation. We don't need Congress. Let me just add this cautionary note. If the players and the owners are unable to find common ground and find it soon so that the 1995 baseball season can begin on time in April, then we will have to find some way to empower those who are the most important element in the baseball equation, the fans.
Dole says the players and the owners can use his office to negotiate if they want. Some lawmakers have threatened to try to remove baseball's antitrust exemption. Authorities in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, say a gunman has killed at least two people and wounded at least two more. Police say a man with a high-powered rifle opened fire on passing cars. He was eventually captured. A witness has told a local television station the gunman fired at least 25 to 30 shots. Jewish settlers started clearing land to expand a settlement north of Jerusalem today, but the Israeli army declared the work illegal and stopped it. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The settlers' attempted expansion came one day after the Israeli government approved the construction of more than 3,000 new homes in three settlements around Jerusalem. Palestinians were furious, saying the government decision violates the Israel-PLO peace agreement. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin says his government has agreed to freeze new construction in the West Bank, except for areas around Jerusalem. The 130,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank say they will continue their campaign to expand their enclaves as they did today north of Jerusalem. Also near Bethlehem, settlers put four mobile homes on an area they claim is theirs. The PLO says that continued expansion of Jewish settlements threatens the peace agreement, and Palestinians and settlers have clashed recently at several sites. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Prosecutors in the O.J. Simpson murder trial have been given a few hours today to prepare motions on last-minute witnesses who were introduced by the defense this week. Deputy District Attorney Christopher Darden says the witnesses are heroin addicts, thieves, and in one case, a pathological liar. The trial has been recessed until later this afternoon. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 2 points to 3,869. The Nasdaq is down almost 3. This is NPR. Members of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan have won a legal victory in Ohio. The Attorney General's office has ruled the Klan can take part in the state's Adopt a Highway program. Maria Vital of Ohio Public Radio has this report.
Travelers passing through Ohio may soon see new signs of Klan activity along the highway. The State Transportation Department may soon be putting up road signs, noting a stretch of highway has been adopted by the KKK. Department spokesman Peter Wyckoff says the state's lawyers believe the Klan has a constitutional right to take part in the Adopt a Highway program.
I don't know what the effect of having a couple of signs up on the highway for this particular group will be, and I really don't think it's going to have any kind of dramatic effect one way or the other.
Groups ranging from the Boy Scouts to an organization supporting legalization of marijuana have also taken part in the program, in which volunteers pledge to clear litter from alongside a state highway. For National Public Radio, I'm Maria Vitale in Columbus.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher is urging Congress not to cut funding for United Nations peacekeepers. He's told the House International Relations Committee the cut would be devastating since other countries would follow the U.S.'s lead. Christopher also says the president of the United States would lose a tool for advancing U.S. interests. He says every president has had this power since Truman. A Republican-sponsored bill would cut more than $1 billion for indirect costs for the U.N. It would effectively wipe out the entire U.S. contribution to peacekeeping missions. President Clinton is working to gather support for his efforts to help college students. He spoke to a small group of college and university administrators today. The president is defending his plan allowing direct government loans to students. He is also criticizing efforts by some lawmakers who want to end his national service program for college students. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a Western woman in the Middle East, Geraldine Brooks was bewildered by the place of women in the Islamic world. In Saudi Arabia, women lead secluded lives and are not allowed to drive. Yet in several predominantly Muslim countries, such as Pakistan, Turkey, and Bangladesh, women have been elected prime minister. This disparity indicated to Brooks that Islam didn't have to mean the oppression of women. So why were so many Muslim women oppressed? She tried to learn as much as she could about the lives of Muslim women while she reported from the Middle East for the Wall Street Journal from 1987 to 1992. Now she's written a new book called Nine Parts of Desire, The Hidden World of Islamic Women. At one time, she was thinking of naming her book The Prophet's Daughters. A leader of the militant fundamentalist group Hezbollah warned her not to use that title. I asked her what he found offensive.
I think it wasn't even so much the title, but the fact that the book was going to purport to discuss the family life of the Prophet Muhammad and to look at how events in the Prophet's own life then went on to shape the lives of Islamic women. And that the book still does that in exactly the same way that it was always intended to. The change of title was purely for personal reasons. I thought that when I read the hadith or saying of Muhammad's son-in-law, Ali ibn Abu Talib, who became the founder of the Shiite sect of Islam, he was talking about women's sexuality. And he said, Almighty God created sexual desire in 10 parts, then gave 9 parts to women and 1 to men. I was so blown away by that thought that it just seemed to me that title explained so much about women that was a much better title for the book.
Well, before we get to an explanation of what that saying means and how you interpreted it, I'm just wondering with the Hezbollah leader if that disturbed you at all, that he had troubles with what you intended to explore in the book.
I think it comes very much from the aftermath of the Salman Rushdie fatwa, and I think a chill descended on all people who were trying to study or write about Islam, that there was an idea around for quite some time and probably still around in many places that Muslims somehow had the right not to be offended and that you mustn't therefore explore any of the ideas that are central to the faith. And I think that's a misunderstanding of one of the real strengths of the faith, which is unlike Christianity, Muslims don't say that Prophet Muhammad was anything other than a human being. And in the Quran itself, God criticizes Muhammad. In the early days of Islam, there was always a back and forth between Muhammad and his followers. And the right to discuss and to criticize was there in the early days of Islam. So I don't see why it should be pulled away now by a few modern leaders of the faith.
Let me get back to the title of your book, Nine Parts of Desire, which comes from the quote, Almighty God created sexual desire in 10 parts, then he gave 9 parts to women and 1 to men. Are there different interpretations of what that means?
I don't think there's different interpretations about what it means. What it leads to it sort of leads in two very different directions. What it means is that Islam acknowledges that women are sexual beings, that they have a right to sexuality. It's a God-given gift. And that can lead you in two directions. It can lead you to say that because they're such sexual beings, they have to be controlled and contained. Or it can lead you to say, listen, God's given this sexuality to women. Let's treasure it. Let's enjoy it. Let's certainly not bring into Islam teachings from other cultures that say women's genitals must be mutilated to the point where they can't ever get any pleasure from sex. How you can bring that into a faith that has this as one of its earliest teachings seems to me a very strange thing, that the two have become conflated.
In your book, you write that you are constantly bewildered by the contradictions between repression and sexual license through the Middle East. Maybe you could give us an example of what you mean.
Well, because Islam appreciates human sexuality, Muhammad, in his sayings and in his own life, he was always stressing that he hadn't come with a message of monasticism. In Islam, celibacy is not an exalted state. It's considered profoundly unnatural, and you don't aspire to be celibate. You aspire to be married and to express your sexuality within the rules of marriage. And I used to contrast it with the Roman Catholic tradition that I grew up in, where we were raised on St. Paul's message that marriage was very much a second choice for the weak-willed. You should be celibate. But if you felt that you couldn't be celibate, then marry, because it's better to marry than to burn. Well, Islam teaches something entirely different to that. It teaches that within marriage, basically anything goes. You and your husband should enjoy each other, and that a woman has right to sexual pleasure. Muhammad taught that foreplay was very important. When he was speaking once about cruelty, he said, "Sex without foreplay is cruelty to women."
You interviewed one Saudi oil executive who told you that he thought that the American obsession with sexual equality was really just a front for immorality. And then he asked if he could introduce you to some of his friends, and he took you to meet his friends at a disco with half-naked women dancers. And how do you reconcile those two things?
I was stunned by this. This guy, I'd had an interview with him, and he'd been this was at the time of the Gulf War, and he'd also told me that he thought it was appalling and disgusting that CNN had sent a woman reporter to cover the war, because, you know, there she was on TV in the holy soil of Saudi Arabia. And then, you know, this little disco room was in his own house, and it had flashing lights and a terrific sound system and a well-stocked bar, which is completely illegal in Saudi Arabia and illegal in Islam to be drinking alcohol. And he was sitting there swishing the scotch round in his glass and telling me how he'd hired a prostitute to go to Switzerland skiing with him. And I didn't know for a long time how he could hold these two completely contradictory ideas in his mind. And then I got a little bit of insight into it when I was reading Naguib Mahfouz's novel Palace Walk. And the patriarch character in that book is very strict husband who sequesters his wife and his daughters, and who's a devout Muslim who prays. But he also goes out whoring with the women entertainers of Cairo. And when the local sheikh in the novel admonishes him for this behavior, he says, well, you know that in the early days of Islam, Muslims were free to have as much sex as they liked with their slave girls and their war captives, and these women entertainers are just our modern equivalent of those. And I think that for that Saudi guy, the women that were dancing in his little disco room were also an equivalent of those kind of non-Muslim, or if Muslim, so lapsed that it doesn't matter. But in any case, they were not Saudi women. And he was drawing a line between the women of the faith and the kafir or the infidel women, and it didn't matter how you treated them.
You assume that women who wore the veil were at least free from the beauty industry, But in your travels, you learned that even that wasn't true.
That was an extremely naive assumption on my part. I thought, well, one good thing about being veiled from head to foot is you won't have to bother about shaving your legs. But then I found that actually, one of the amazing things about Islam is that it touches every part of life. And one of the consequences of the teaching of the value of sex in marriage is that as a woman, you should be really beautiful for your husband. And culturally, most Muslims consider body hair unbeautiful, in fact, sexually repulsive. In most Muslim countries that I visited, it's Islamically recommended for women to remove all their body hair every 20 days and for men every 40 days. And before you go to your wedding, you'll be completely depilated, usually using a paste of honey and lemon, and all the hair will come off. So if you see somebody, a veiled woman, and she doesn't pluck her eyebrows, that probably means she's single. Because a married woman will probably be quite particular about that. So women spend a great deal of time looking wonderful. And I got my biggest shock in this regard when I went to interview some of the women of Hezbollah. And I'd met them in public, and all I could see was a tiny little triangle with basically just nose, eyes, and a little bit of lip. And then when I went to meet them in their room, I knocked on the door. And when the woman opened it, I thought, oh, I've got the wrong room here, because she was wearing a beautiful sheer silk nightgown with a plunge neckline, and she had streaked blonde hair right down to her waist, and she was a knockout. And the other women in the room were equally elaborately done up, and they laughed at me, and they said, you know, of course we hide ourselves from people to whom it would be immodest to show ourselves, but at home, for each other and for our husbands, of course, we want to be as beautiful as we can.
So the pressure of being beautiful is still on. You just have to cover up in public.
In fact, it's probably on more because there's always, in some countries, polygamy is still quite common. Islam allows men to take up to four wives, and although it's becoming less common as time goes on, it's still a threat that hangs over a woman that, if she's not beautiful, her husband might go out and find a young, lovely wife and set up a separate housekeeping with her. And it's a little like the Western male midlife crisis, you know, the older wife or the wife of the youth being shunted aside for this younger one.
My guest is Geraldine Brooks. She's the author of the new book, Nine Parts of Desire, The Hidden World of Islamic Women. And it's based on her journeys through the Middle East when she was reporting there for the Wall Street Journal. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about Islamic women. My guest is Geraldine Brooks, author of the new book, Nine Parts of Desire. When you were traveling through the Middle East reporting for the Wall Street Journal, you were traveling with your husband, but you were often alone, especially when you were on assignment. What was the range of attitudes that you got from government officials and from other interviewees as a Western woman alone?
There's quite a wide range of reactions. I didn't have too much trouble with government officials in the Middle East because a lot of them are Western educated, or at least they've spent time in the West or understand what Western women are about. What frustrated me at first was that I wasn't really free to do the kind of street level reporting, the sort of, I like to report from the bottom up rather than the top down. When I went out in the streets or in the coffee shops and just started talking to strange men, their reactions would be either complete embarrassment, or they saw it as an opportunity to test a widely held assumption that Western women are whores. And this came from the fact that in many of the Gulf countries, particularly, men just don't routinely speak to women that they're not related to. So I was a bit of an anomaly there.
When you say that men would test the assumption that Western women are whores, would they come on to you as you tried to interview them?
Yes, because, you know, interviewing is about forming a rapport and being very interested in what someone has to say. And for some of these guys, this was the first time that a woman had been smiling at them, listening to them, leaning forward. You just don't do that. And I had to completely modify my approach and learn to be very reserved, which is not great interviewing technique. And so it wasn't until I actually started talking to women and then getting to know their husbands through the wives and through the relationship I already had with the wives that things became much easier for me.
When you were interviewing a man who misinterpreted your curiosity and thought that you were coming on to him and he started to come on to you, what would you do?
You just have to be very unpleasant and just sort of shut the whole conversation down and leave as quickly as you possibly could.
You went to the Middle East with your husband, Tony Horowitz, who's also a writer and journalist. What interested you the most about what he could do that you couldn't do in certain Middle East countries?
Well, again, in the beginning, he, being a guy, had no trouble talking to guys. So I was absolutely disheartened after about 6 months when I was going through our clipping book where we took our articles and pasted them up. And he would have great sounding headlines like Egyptian camel corps tracks smugglers through the desert and life on a supply boat in the mine-strewn waters of the Persian Gulf. And I would see those and just see red because I wasn't able, the Egyptian army wouldn't send a woman out on patrol with the Camel Corps, and the shipping agents in the Gulf wouldn't let a woman go out on a dhow, on a supply boat. So, you know, I was feeling very envious of him. But then once I started exploring the lives of women, I began to have my own adventures and things equalized a little bit.
Well, not only couldn't you go riding with the Camel Corps, you couldn't get a hotel room by yourself in Saudi Arabia.
That's right. I actually ended up getting arrested for having the temerity to try and check into a hotel by myself. The clerk on the desk said it was illegal for women to travel alone in Saudi Arabia without official permission from the police, because the only possible reason that a woman could be alone was if she was a prostitute. So I ended up spending much of that night in the Dhahran police station while a young police lieutenant perused every piece of identification I had and finally gave me permission to spend the last few hours of what was left of the night in that hotel. And when I got back there, they took me to a completely empty floor with an armed guard posted at the elevator.
Were you angry by then, or were you used to it?
By the time that one happened, I was pretty used to it, and I kind of had, at first there was kind of a burning anger when I'd see how women were treated, and I let that sometimes affect my behavior. But then I realized, hey, you know, you're not here as some kind of avenging sword of Western feminism, you're here to find out what's going on, and one way to find out what's going on is to be subjected to some of these things yourself. So I began to sort of take it in stride and try and see everything as a learning experience.
You traveled with a veil. For what occasions would you actually put it on?
Sometimes if you were interviewing somebody from Islamic Jihad or Hezbollah, a man, they would feel uncomfortable sitting in a room with a woman who wasn't covered. And so I'd wear it on request. And in Iran, the law is that all women, whatever their religious faith, have to be covered. The rule is you can show your hands and face, but all hair and all curves of the body have to be covered up somehow. And how you do that's pretty much up to you. But I found that the chador was kind of the easiest all-purpose garment to wear.
You converted to Judaism when you married your husband because he's Jewish. You were brought up Roman Catholic. And when you got married, you had no idea you'd eventually be stationed in the Middle East, where a lot of people would think of you as being the enemy because you were Jewish. What was your attitude toward when and how and if to reveal to people that you were Jewish?
I only denied being Jewish once very early on in my time in the Middle East, and it was just a sort of a nervous impulse because of all the stereotypes that I'd heard about how Arabs particularly felt about Jews. And I felt so cowardly and just disgusted with myself for doing that, that I made a rule after that that no matter what the circumstances were, if somebody asked me a direct question, I would tell them the truth. And so that was what I did. And most of the time, it didn't come up.
In your acknowledgments, you thank Deborah Amos, Christiane Amanpour, Nora Bustani, Jackie Leiden, and Milton Vjorst for good company in war zones. Everyone in that list, except for Milton Vjorst, is a woman. And I was wondering if you sought out the company of women journalists during the Gulf War or whether you were coincidentally with them.
This was something that I learned from Muslim women, because from the time I left my old girls' high school to get my first job, which was as a cadet in the sports department on of an Australian newspaper, my career always pushed me into a man's world. And it wasn't until I started, you know, really seeking out Muslim women and spending time with them and entering their wonderfully sort of feminine, sisterly company that I realized that I personally hadn't made a close woman friend since I'd left high school. And I thought, you know, there's something wrong with this picture. And then I did start to seek them out, thank God, you know.
So you sought out the company of other women journalists.
Yes, that's right. And continue to seek out the company of other women, because I realized that it was a gap that had developed in my life and I hadn't even noticed it until by spending time with Muslim women, I saw the kinds of deep, deep sisterly friendships that they had and realized that they were at that time missing in my life.
What was the turning point for you in deciding that you were going to make women a focus of your reporting in the Middle East?
It came during the first year when we were based in Cairo, and I had a news assistant there, an Egyptian woman. When I arrived, she'd already been working for the journal for a couple of years. She was a couple of years younger than me, very sophisticated, beautiful, precise, formal English, wonderful hairdos, very stylish, lots of makeup. And she seemed an entirely Western figure to me in some ways. She was a graduate and she was planning to do postgraduate studies at Harvard, and she was admitted there. And then suddenly, after I'd known her for about a year, it was Ramadan, the holy month when Muslims fast from dawn to dusk, and she arrived for work the first morning of Ramadan completely veiled. The elaborate curls were gone under a severe blue scarf. The makeup was scrubbed away. Instead of the fashionable clothes, she was wearing a dowdy sort of a sack. And I just stared at her. I was stunned, because up until then, my assumption had been that people who embraced Orthodox Islam or fundamentalist Islam were the desperate cases, the really poor people, the people who were looking for some heavenly solace to make up for the grimness of their lives. Well, Saha's life was not grim, and she had lots of choices, and that was the choice she made. And that was what really started me asking the question, why Saha?
And why? I mean, what answers have you come up with?
I think that there are a number of answers. On the political level, I think people like Saha, well-educated people, have seen their countries going down the tubes for years under, first in the case of Egypt, socialism that was imported from the Soviet Union. I think Saha had seen Western systems embraced in Egypt. She'd seen socialism embraced. None of them had brought any answers. And so she started to look for something of her own. And she said, what's our own? Islam's ours, and we should try Islam.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
Geraldine Brooks is the author of Nine Parts of Desire, The Hidden World of Islamic Women. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Random House, publisher of Philip K. Howard's The Death of Common Sense, How the Law is Suffocating America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Libby Gelman-Waxner tells us how she became America's most beloved and irresponsible film critic. She says movies are about more than directors' searing and soaring personal vision. They're about watching Sylvester Stallone mowing down bad guys while tucking his submachine gun under his arm like a clutch bag. They're about Cher's wigs, Madonna's abs, and Michelle Pfeiffer's cheekbones. Libby is the alter ego of humorist, playwright, and screenwriter Paul Rudnick, whose credits include the film Adam's Family Values. We'll talk with him about a new collection of Libby's columns. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a couple of collections and a new release by country singer George Jones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Police in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, say a gunman fatally shot two people today with a high-powered rifle. Two other people were wounded. A spokeswoman says the gunman was taken into custody within an hour of the shootings. One witness says the gunfire started in or near the courthouse across the street from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The House is nearing a vote on a balanced budget amendment. Already today, the House has given preliminary approval to a provision that would require a 3/5 majority of Congress to approve any tax increases. NPR's Brian Naylor has more from Capitol Hill.
253 House members voted for the so-called 3/5 version, nearly all the chamber's Republicans, but just 33 Democrats. There are several other versions of the balanced budget amendment to be debated and voted on. At the end of the debate, the version with the most votes will then be the subject of a final vote in which 290 House members, or 2/3 of the House, must approve. The version likely to win the most support is a plan which many Democrats back that requires just a simple majority to raise taxes, but calls for supermajorities to raise the debt ceiling and to run a deficit. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Defense Secretary William Perry says U.S. troops will be facing a dicey situation when they help evacuate the 8,000 United Nations peacekeepers from Somalia. The evacuation is expected to start at the end of next month. The U.S. is sending 3,000 Marines for the operation. The BBC's Roger Hearing has this report.
This will be the third time in less than 3 years that an American-led task force has been sent to Somalia. After the original intervention in 1992, Operation Restore Hope, there were the reinforcements to support the U.S. pullout in March 1993, Operation Quickdraw, and now the plan to get the last U.N. troops off the beaches, Operation United Shield. Lieutenant General Anthony Zini, who will command the combined international force, is paying a short visit to Mogadishu, U.S. officials say, to make sure his plans match those of U.N. contingent commanders. American, Pakistani, French, Italian, and Malaysian ships will be involved in the operation. One of the main objects is to ensure the safe removal of tanks and other heavy equipment used by U.N. soldiers.
Roger Hearing reporting. Attorney General Janet Reno thinks it's a bad idea to repeal the assault weapons ban. She says the country doesn't need weapons that don't have a recreational purpose and are essentially instruments of death. Reno's comments come after a report more than 24 House Democrats support Republican efforts to repeal the ban. The 26 Democrats sent a letter to House Speaker Newt Gingrich saying the ban is an ill-conceived measure. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost a little more than a point to end at 3,870. But on the broader market, advancers led decliners by a thin margin. This is NPR. Japanese national police have again increased the earthquake death toll. 5,083 people died in Japan's quake. 51 people are still missing. The number of damaged or destroyed buildings is now set at 88,000. Health officials are now worried about a flu outbreak and the spread of other diseases. There are 300,000 people who are homeless. The American Bankers Association says the Federal Reserve will probably raise interest rates by 0.5 percentage point next week. The comments come as Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan testifies for a second day on Capitol Hill. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The Fed's Open Market Committee is scheduled to meet next Tuesday and again February 1st. The Bankers Association's semiannual economic forecast predicts that the Fed will raise interest rates another 0.5 percentage point by mid-year. The Federal Reserve increased rates 6 times last year by a total of 2 percentage points. The The ABA says if the Fed does move to hike rates again, it should stop and assess what effect their past and present actions are having on the economy before they continue tightening. The group warns if the Fed repeats its actions of 1994, it could trigger a recession. The comments come as Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan testifies for a second day on Capitol Hill. Yesterday, he went before the Senate Finance Committee and warned that the economy is growing too quickly to hold down inflation. He stopped short of saying whether the central bank will respond by boosting interest rates again. Today, Greenspan testifies before the Senate Budget Committee. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Survivors of the Nazi death camp in Auschwitz, Poland, are returning there to mark its liberation. Tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of the camp's liberation by Soviet soldiers. 90% of the 1.5 million people murdered there were Jewish. A march was staged through the gates of the Auschwitz-Birkenau complex today. Gray-haired Jewish men walked through wearing prayer shawls like the ones stolen from their fathers and grandfathers. A prayer for the dead was recited. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Libby Gelman-Waxner isn't shy about stating she is America's foremost auteurist film critic. But before she became a columnist for Premier Magazine, taking on the daunting task of molding the tastes of a nation, she claims she was just an average American filmgoer, leaving her charmingly eclectic home in search of naked movie stars, exploding squad cars, and a good look at Cher's latest surgical procedure. Not all of her readers know that she is really the creation of humorist, playwright, and screenwriter Paul Rudnick. His credits include the film Adam's Family Values and the play Jeffrey, a comedy about love in the age of AIDS. Libby's film columns have been collected in the new book, If You Ask Me. We invited Paul Rudnick to share some of Libby's insights into contemporary cinema. First, to introduce us to Libby, he'll read from the introduction of her new collection.
5 years ago, when Premier Magazine first begged me to become their in-house film critic and ultimate auteurist authority, I had to ask myself, Libby, you already have it all. What do you need this for? As my devoted readers know, I am an extremely successful assistant buyer in Junior's activewear. Every year, I help decide exactly which Calvin Klein silk charmeuse slip dress will tempt our customers into having enough surgery to be able to wear it. I also have two perfect children, my daughter Jennifer and my little Mitchell Sean. Motherhood is a 24-hour-a-day job. Just ask my housekeeper and my two nannies, but let's leave the au pair out of this, because that navel ring is making me very nervous, even on a Wellesley girl. Especially on a Wellesley girl. And of course, I am also devoted to my flawless husband, Josh, who is not only a wildly sought-after Upper East Side orthodontist, whose clientele includes the children of many celebrities' attorneys, but who can also balance a light beer, two different bags of chips, three remote controls, the TV guide, the latest John Grisham, a cellular phone, and a Master Blaster water pistol to keep the cat and the kids away from the chips, all on a single arm of his recliner. With all this in my life, plus the Stairmaster, which I use backwards without holding on to the handrails, thank you very much, how could I make room to mold the film going of a nation? Why did I decide to do it? To offer my nuggets of auteuristic insight every month in the pages of a magazine which never contains enough perfume strips? The answer is you. Yes, I did it for you, the wonderful, loving, dedicated, ignorant American Cineplex addict. I do it because I love you. Every one of you. Even the ones who actually pretend to enjoy French movies about the ambiguity of love at the beach. Or any French movies at all. Or any movies that aren't in color or in English, for that matter. I do it because I can hear America crying out, saying, please, Libby, tell us what you think. Guide us. Help us understand the differences between the various Baldwin brothers. Heal us. I am here for America and the world to wonder if in just a few years our preschools will be filled with toddlers named Merrill, Glenn, Macaulay, Christian, and Winona. I am here to say yes. Do not be ashamed. Join with me. Let us all gather as one and shout, take us, Harrison Ford, and bring Tommy Lee Jones with you. Both of you, take us now.
Paul Rudnick, why did you create Libby Gelman-Waxner?
Well, I felt the last thing the world needed was another actual breathing film critic. I think there are far too many as it is. But perhaps the world needed Libby, needed someone who didn't censor their film-going responses, but just immediately said, oh, I want to buy, I want to date, I want to wear. So that's how she goes to the movies, as if it's all just a giant catalog.
Is she based on people that you know?
Well, she's based on myself in part, on women I know, on everyone. I think she's the child in us that goes to the movies and the adult child who just, I guess, goes to the movies as not just an escape, but as a way of planning our own lives, who rather than saying, oh, I'm at an artistic event and I will analyze and critique, they go to think, ah, wouldn't that be a great apartment in Woody Allen's Manhattan? Or, ooh, you know, if I were Mel Gibson, I wouldn't marry Diane Keaton in Mrs. Sofol, or whatever their response is. It's on a very personal level. I think that's actually, that was probably what gave birth to Libby, was that sense of, oh, Americans especially taking movies so much to heart, not treating them as if there's any dividing line between their own lives and that and what they're watching on the screen.
Has Libby seen Little Women?
Yes, she did, which she enjoyed very much because she felt it verged on Merchant Ivory. She felt that it was the kind of film that made you just want to be a nice young white girl at the turn of the century. I think it actually is a beautifully made movie. But it had that kind of real glamour satisfaction in that the fancier the actress was, the more she was allowed to wear eye makeup. And the fact that Winona Ryder was being treated as if she was the plain little woman, and
yes,
that she was the one who somehow would be forced into a career as a writer because she couldn't nab a guy. And I thought, well, that's satisfying that it's Winona Ryder, the way in the earlier film it was Katharine Hepburn. Somehow you think, no, this isn't exactly, you know, a plain Jane situation.
Susan Sarandon's part as the mother, in which she's always just so self-sacrificing and making speeches about womanhood to her daughters, really reminded me of the Susan Sarandon who accepts Academy Awards and makes speeches about the political issue of the day.
Well, she also had what both Libby and I agree was one of the most viciously maternal lines in film history, which is towards the end of the film, Winona inherits a huge, gorgeous New England mansion. And Marmee, played by Susan Sarandon, kind of breezes past Winona and says, well, you know, the house is really too big for anyone to live in, but wouldn't it make a marvelous school? And you think, no, it would make a wonderful house. But somehow, because they're transcendentalists and because they believe in goodness, you know that Winona is suddenly condemned to running a school. And it just seemed like something that Libby or perhaps my own relatives would say. You know that, oh, well, that's a lovely outfit, dear, but you're not leaving the house, are you? It just was, I guess, that moment at which guilt was introduced to New England.
What did Libby's mother think of Little Women?
Well, Libby's mother is Sandra Krell Gelman, who is much beloved and not only is a full-time mom, but also works in real estate at Lovely Spaces, Inc. on Great Neck, Long Island. But so I think she would also approve of Little Women because Susan Sarandon was, you know, both a marvelous mother, and even though the family was supposed to be rather poor, seemed to have plenty of live-in help. That even when the girls were running off to give their one last potato to the poor family in the neighborhood, the potato had been prepared by a live-in cook. So this strikes me as the ideal form of charity. Charity with an apron that works for you.
Pulp Fiction, have you seen it?
Oh, yes. We went together because Libby relishes a good violent film. She sees it as a terrific catharsis. She's, you know, all in favor of people getting blown away, although she'd prefer that they be kind of sloppy dry cleaners or nasty cab drivers or her least favorite relatives, but they're rarely oft in films, so she makes do with having John Travolta shot at point blank range.
Did she pick up any cleaning tips from Harvey Keitel in his role as the wolf who advises the trigger man how to clean blood off the back seat of their expensive car?
Well, Libby, of course, didn't really learn anything, but she did send Mrs. Ramirez, her beloved housekeeper, and a real gem, to see what she could learn.
My guest is humorist, screenwriter, and playwright Paul Rudnick. He created the character of Libby Gilman Waxner, film critic for Premiere Magazine. There's a new collection of Libby's columns called If You Ask Me. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with humorist Paul Rudnick. He writes a satirical film review column under the name Libby Gilman Waxner.
Does Libby ever go to the movies and try to guess who's gay?
Libby feels that that someday will be part of interactive film going, just as there'll be that home shopping window that will appear in the corner of the screen allowing you to purchase whatever Julia Roberts is wearing. There'll be perhaps another little check or maybe a pink triangle that will appear in the upper corner of the screen when a gay actor appears. So, although I think it's funny, I know Libby and I have had conversations about this. There's such panic in Hollywood over whether people would, overall, the mass audience would be able to relate to actors they knew were gay if they were portraying heterosexual characters. I don't know. Somehow people haven't stopped renting Rock Hudson films. You know, I think it may be a non-issue, or at least it's certainly an issue that hasn't begun to be explored. You know, we've had now plenty of heterosexual actors playing gay roles, and that's been very accepted. But I think, you know, wouldn't it be nice to maybe give that mass audience the benefit of the doubt for once and see what would happen?
Hasn't it become kind of a sport to sit around guessing who's gay?
Oh, yes. Well, I think the ideal situation is to assume they all are, you know, and whittle from there. Because after all, you know, the division of people into gay and straight or into tough guy, real man, not a real man, gets awfully silly once you're dealing with people making $12 million to, you know, kiss Sharon Stone.
Tell us something about Libby's best friend and often, screening companion, Stacey Schiff.
Well, Stacey's actually usually referred to as the still tragically single Stacey Schiff. Stacey is just, she's a marketing analyst and lives in hope and despair, as do so many, I think, single gals in New York. So she does attend films with Libby, and they analyze marriage possibilities for Stacey, whether, you know, how long will the Baldwin-Basinger marriage last? Should she settle for a lesser Baldwin brother? Is there any hope of breaking up Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan? You know, so Libby feels that films can help Stacey, and she's, you know, hopes for her, but, oh, it doesn't look good.
When Libby goes to the movies, one of the things she looks for is the tush factor. What is it?
The tush factor is how many times a desirable tush is exposed. That Mel Gibson seems to have it written into his contract that especially when he plays an action hero, like in the Lethal Weapon films, there has to be a scene in which he rises from his early morning bed, takes a sip of coffee, or perhaps grabs a towel, and we get a major glimpse. So Libby's very disappointed, in fact, outraged, when the tush factor is denied. Although, as with Michael Douglas, perhaps the tush factor should have a freshness date on it.
Does Libby suspect that perhaps that is merely a stunt tush?
A
tush double?
Well, I think I think male actors are far more vain about their bodies and nudity than actresses are. I think actresses often much prefer a body double to sub for them. But male actors like to say, yes, I've worked out for, 3 hours before filming, and I want everybody to get a good long look at this, sack of guts. So I think it's very rare that it's someone else, not Richard Gere.
You know, I have a friend who called me up and said, did you know that Paul Rudnick wrote the screenplay for The Santa Claus? And I thought, no, wow, God, he must be wealthy beyond all belief now, and
think how proud his mother would be that he'd have the number one film. And of course, it's Steve Rudnick, not Paul Rudnick.
Sadly, although I don't know if my mother would approve of my doing such a goyish work. But yes, I know it's very sad because Steve Rudnick, who, as far as I know, I'm not related to, and I wish him well. I just wish some of his checks would find their way to me. In fact, I did get a call from the Screenwriters Guild about an arbitration for the credits of another film that I had had nothing to do with. And they got a little huffy, and it suddenly occurred to me. I said, you know, I bet you're looking for Steve Rudnick, the rich Rudnick. So who knows? I'm hoping for some confusion in the future.
What will your next screenplay be? Do you know?
Well, I'm working on a film for Paramount right now that I'm in the middle of. So that I sort of won't discuss because I'm wildly superstitious. And often when I describe something I'm working on, I listen to myself and go, oh, that sounds horrible. Stop now. So I'll leave that one be. But I also have the film of Jeffrey, of my last play, will be out in May.
Oh, did you write the screenplay?
Yes, I did. And we shot it all on location in New York this past summer over a 5-week period. And it was, pretty much a labor of love, I think, for everyone concerned, because God knows no one was making much money on it. But we got just the best cast. Patrick Stewart from Star Trek is in it, and Sigourney Weaver, and Kathy Najimy, Olympia Dukakis, Steven Weber, who's on Wings. So just the greatest cast. And Christopher Ashley, who directed the play on stage, is directing it as a movie.
Great. Yeah, and Jeffrey is your comedy about AIDS.
Yes.
Do you have a cameo for yourself?
It depends. Well, cameo is already far too generous a term. There is an actual split second where if you know me incredibly well, you would be able to spot me. It's in the big gay Pride Day sequence in which I am holding some sort of picket sign. So the very careful viewer will be able to spot me.
Paul Rudnick writes satirical film criticism under the name Libby Gilman Waxner in Premier Magazine. There's a new collection of Libby's columns called If You Ask Me. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we have Linda Gradstein's profile of Itzhak Rabin. Peacemaking apparently has making him unpopular at home. The trial began today in New York of a man charged with murdering commuters on a New York train. He's acting as his own lawyer. Melissa Block is covering that. We will also be keeping up with the O.J. Simpson trial. We're following the balanced budget debate on Capitol Hill, and we will catch up with the man who is helping us to grow some shamrocks. We also have a story on the homeless cafe in New York City where food stamps are accepted. We have a rock and roll band that plays a saxophone and a violin.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For more than 3 decades, George Jones has been one of the most influential of all country music singers. He's currently represented by a trio of recent releases, Cup of Loneliness, the classic Mercury years, The Essential George Jones, The Spirit of Country, and a new studio album of duets, teaming him with leading country stars, called The Bradleys' Barn Sessions. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Step right up, come on in. If you'd like to take the grand tour of a lonely house that once was home, sweet home, I have nothing here to sell you, just some things that I will tell you, some things I know chill you to the bone over there.
To say that George Jones is the most imitated country singer in the music's history is by now a commonplace. His baleful, plaintive voice is redolent of the weary sadness that pervades so much country music, a form filled with tales of exhaustion, defeat, betrayal, and despair. Oh, sure, there are happy country songs, but who wants to hear them when you can listen to this?
Talk to me, oh, lonesome heart.
Help me through this lonely night. Lie to me and tell me everything's all right. Talk to me, oh lonesome heart. Help me through my darkest gloom. Help me bring her memory to this lonely room. Talk to me and let me cry the whole night through. You have lost, but I've lost as much as you. So talk to me.
That's from Cup of Loneliness, a two-disc set that offers the purest honky-tonking Jones recorded in the 50s and 60s with beautifully unadorned production, courtesy of Pappy Daly. The other greatest hits collection, The Essential George Jones, more or less picks up where that one leaves off, with Jones making a crucial change in producers in the late 60s. He started working with Billy Sherrill, who had the then-heretical idea of cushioning George's pain with soothing orchestrations and backup vocals. This approach has ruined as many country careers as it has expanded. Luckily for Jones and us, Sherrill's best work makes George's genius for florid emotionalism sound agonizingly eloquent.
Cause you're my shelter from the storm now. I don't need wine to keep me warm now. No temptation can ever shake our love's foundation. We're strong enough to take it. We can make it.
The Bradley's Barn Sessions is brand new George Jones music, pairing him on different cuts with younger country stars like Alan Jackson, Trisha Yearwood, and Travis Tritt. There's also a fine bluesy duet with the Rolling Stones' Keith Richards, who only looks older than George. The sad idea behind this collection is that since country radio only plays young whippersnappers these days, George needs help from younger people. But listen to him running rings around Marty Stewart on this fun song, and you'll know who really needs the help.
You told me that you loved me, I would feel so proud. Let me hold you, honey, I'd holler out loud. I'll never love another, even if I can. Come to me, baby, I'm a one-woman man.
Oh, won't you let me, baby, just to kind of hang around. I'll always love you, honey, and I'll never let you down.
I'll never love another, even if I can. Come to me, baby, I'm a one-woman man.
Unlike most of his contemporaries, George Jones, now well into his 60s, is still working in peak form. He's being treated like a living legend, but he deserves to be heard as a lively artist.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed three new releases from George Jones: Cup of Loneliness, the classic Mercury Years on Mercury Records, The Essential George Jones, The Spirit of Country on Epic, and The Bradley's Barn Sessions on MCA. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our program was directed today by Roberta Shurrock and Alan Tu. I'm Terry Gross.
Darling, let's talk around town about a girl who spreads love around.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.